Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with actor, storyteller, mime, Bill Bowers. Bill is here in Sarasota having performed at the Sarasolo Solo Festival, and he will be back on March 15th performing A Work in Progress, a new piece at the historic Oslo Theater in their Unplugged series. Bill's story is unusual. As I say in the interview, he is the first mime I ever interviewed, and in fact, there are few mimes that I could interview. But how Bill went from a boy who learned that there were things too dangerous to speak to a man who not only makes his living some of the time by not speaking, but is a voluble, interesting, funny, charming storyteller. Hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. And as I say every week, this may seem to some of you some kind of oxymoron. How can I be somebody I'm not? What does that mean, being who you really are? But I think most of you know exactly what I'm talking about. And that is because so many of us have felt the need to pretend to be other, something that we're not, or at the very least, to keep secret something that we are. This is unfortunately so common that I'm fairly sure that most of you who are listening have had the experience in your life of feeling a little self-conscious or ashamed or embarrassed or reticent even to let somebody know something about you. I like to give the example that, you know, of laughing at a joke that you don't really get, so that people won't think that you didn't get it. That is an example of, you know, this is something about me that I think I'm a little embarrassed about or ashamed of. I don't want you to know that I'm not that smart, that I don't get your joke. This is an intention. I am hiding something about myself. And in the interview that I'm going to air today, Bill Bowers, the really internationally known mime and actor and storyteller, will talk about what so many people have had to hide, and that is the fact of their gender identification. But that's not the only thing that we feel compelled to hide. As I indicated, you know, we might not want people to know that we're not as smart as we think we should be, whatever that means. Or I'm a psychotherapist, in case you didn't know and couldn't tell. And a client that I had once was very uncomfortable about her weight. And she would wear what she called fakey facades. This was clothing that theoretically disguised her weight so that she could pretend not to be as heavy as she is. But it isn't only that. I know lots of people who are reluctant to tell you what they think. They're afraid that what they think is not smart enough or interesting enough. But again, these are things that we do intentionally. These are things that we choose to hide or dissemble. I'm actually talking about stuff that when we were young, we decided it was unattractive. It was not going to bring us the attention, the affection, the love, the care, or might even bring us neglect or punishment or abandonment. And so we learned not only to hide these things from others, but to hide them from ourselves. So we come into adulthood thinking that we're not very smart, not realizing or knowing that we have opinions, thinking that we're someone without opinions, thinking that we're someone who doesn't care about anything, know about anything, have a passion about anything, thinking that we're shy or it doesn't matter. It's person specific. Whatever it was that your particular childhood told you was not going to bring you what you wanted and might bring you something you didn't want, that was something that you could learn to hide, finally, even from yourself. But our lives are diminished by what we hide from ourselves. And so the Lynn Show is about making the point that, yes, this might have happened to you. You might have loved to sing, but were told that you didn't sound good, or that you shouldn't sing those songs, or you were making too much noise, and so now you have a very little voice that you can sometimes sing with, but it's not really you. Or maybe you had an opinion at the kitchen table and were told that you should be seen and not heard, or who do you think you are, or nobody asked you, or, you know, when I want to know what you think, or any of that, right? So you don't know what you think. Well, it is the point of this show and the point of the work I do as a therapist to say, it's still there, and you can have it back. Not that that's an easy thing, not just because I said it, and even if you recognize it, you say, oh, yep, let me have that back. Because when it begins to come back, it comes back with all the taboo that made you want to pretend you didn't have it in the first place, and that can be very unpleasant. And that, of course, is one of the jobs of psychotherapy, to help you to discover if there's something that you have been in denial for, help you begin to recover it, help you to tolerate the journey back to recovery so you can be who you really are. And in order to make this point, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And today's interview with Bill Bowers makes this point in neon. I don't want to say too much about it because Bill is very articulate. This is a funny thing to say about a mime, but he is. And he tells it better. So now here, the really talented, really courageous, really interesting Bill Bowers. Okay, I am here with Bill Bowers, an internationally known mime. Probably there are not that many people who have this title. You and Marcel, really?
Yeah, and he's dead.
And he's dead. Exactly, exactly. So we still have you. And Bill is here performing at the Sarah Solo Festival, and he did his show last night to screaming standing ovation. So I'm explaining to Bill that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and Bill is my first mime. And I only ask one question. Do you remember the very first moment in your life when mime, silent communication, communication itself, trying to reach other people with your body, drew you, occurred to you, became a possibility? Do you?
I didn't, I do, but it's, my memory of that isn't about performing any kind of nonverbal or physical theater. My first true memory of it was in my family at a very young age. I was the youngest in my family, and seeing what wasn't being talked about in our family. That's really where it begins for me.
So are you saying that even as a child, and how old are we talking here?
5, 6.
You had the conscious thought there are things not being said here?
Yeah.
Really?
I do. I remember this thinking that there's something in this room that is bigger than everybody that's upsetting.
Wow.
And so for me, I mean, just to get personal right away, is I was my oldest sister was marrying a guy that my family didn't want, my parents didn't want her to marry, and they were throwing her out of the house, they were disowning her. And I, as a little boy, it was destroying the family in front of me.
Yes.
But none of that was getting said. I had to learn it later, what was happening.
So what you had was the sensation.
Yeah.
Right? Was it physical? Do you know?
Well, it was physical because I could see people separately sobbing.
Oh.
It was like separating everybody. And but no one was talking about what it was that was happening.
So as this 5-year-old boy, do you think you knew what it was they weren't talking about? Or it was just really clear to you that they weren't?
Probably, that's a good question. Probably it was more clear to me that they weren't talking about the very thing that was in the room. I didn't know what it was, but it was the fact that they couldn't say something or weren't saying something was the problem.
This is absolutely fascinating to me. I know you have a 4-year-old son.
Mm-hmm.
So you have some idea of what it is to be 4 or 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Do you not think it's quite extraordinary that you had, not only that you felt this, because I don't think that's so unusual, I think children feel all that stuff,
mm-hmm.
but that you actually had a thought about it, that you made some conclusion of it, that it was, do you understand the point I'm making here?
Yeah. I did, well, yeah, but I didn't know what to do about it.
Well, no, I understand that. But that, I mean, you can remember it now.
Yeah.
So obviously it was so clear to you mm-hmm. that this was missing somehow, that this was wrong even, or painful, or, right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, yeah. So this is the beginning. So, this is so interesting to me. So how do you make the leap from people are not talking to I will find a way to communicate without talking?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's kind of what the leap was. And I guess the other part of that experience I was just telling you about is, so at a very young age, I also knew that if I said what I wanted to do, I might get disowned.
Oh, you know? God, right.
So there was that element too, and also I am a gay man. I didn't know what that meant when I was a little boy, but I soon was discovering that who I was and what I felt was different than everyone else around me. So I thought, if I express that, I'm out of here.
Right.
So it took away words. That's really... And I still didn't know what mime was. I didn't know there was an art form about mime, but I was... My life was heading right to it.
That's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. 'Cause lots of people, most people, I'll go out on a limb here and say that most people would have shut down entirely, mm-hmm. would not have spoken, would have found a way, would not have spoken, would not have communicated, would have found a way to stop feeling, to stop having anything to say that might get them disowned. Mm-hmm. Not that they would have found a way. Do you know what I'm trying to say here?
Well, I think that's the gift I got. I probably am emotionally shut down in certain ways because of how I was raised, but I found this other form that allowed me to put my feelings somewhere and also make art.
Yes.
And that has led me through my life, so,
it's quite extraordinary, I think. I mean, I don't think that this is, well, we don't have that many mimes, so, right?
Yeah.
And while we don't have that many mimes, we have millions of people who have had your experience.
Yes.
Which is, I'm afraid to be myself.
Right.
I'm afraid to say my truth.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's incredibly common.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't have a lot of mimes.
Yeah.
So not a lot of people have this gift, find this way. What are you thinking?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking to Marcel Marceau, who was my teacher, and he has a similar story in a certain way, in that he was a Jew, and he was in hiding.
Ah, yes.
And his parents sent him and his brother off to Paris because they thought it would be safer for him, and it was because they were taken off and taken to the camp. So he changed his name, and he was, a group of people helped him and his brother hide. And he said that's what trained him as a mime more than anything, was he, not that he was comfortable with, but he was very familiar with not talking and not saying who he was.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's what you can't know, but the theme of the Lin Show is being who you really are.
Oh, wow.
It's my belief that most of us come out of childhood having to pretend that something that is true about us isn't true about us.
Uh-huh.
To be in denial for something important about us. So what do we do about that? And it is my experience that most people find a way to pretend they're not who they are.
Uh-huh.
And they go through life essentially pretending they're not who they are.
Uh-huh.
So you have this, I think, quite extraordinary awareness as a very young child. So how do you go from there at 5 with this understanding that you have to keep secrets about yourself, that it's dangerous
mm-hmm.
to say who you are, demonstrate who you are? How do you go from there to this person who's figured out how to say who he is? Oh, it's not an easy question.
Yeah, it's not an easy question.
Do you know?
I don't know that I know. I'll try to say it. I think that's been my experience as a mime, is that I discovered there was an art form about not talking, and I thought, well, perfect, because that is what I don't want to do. And that's a safe place for me, and I had a skill and a gift at it, and so I got attention and...
Well, okay, tell us the story of how you discovered that that's a... Because you haven't said, but I know, that you grew up in Montana
mm-hmm.
in a very rural, rather backward... No?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, right. I got this information from the show. You'll just have to come see Bill, you know.
Yeah.
But, I mean, mime is a very special technique. I can't imagine there were very, very many mimes where you were. So how did you discover this art form?
In a nutshell, as you said, I grew up in Montana, which is a very big, quiet place.
Mm-hmm.
And
in addition, quiet. Right, not just your family, but the whole place.
Yeah, I mean, just the silence of nature. It's a huge silence, and I love that. And my family, my mom's family at home set it out there, so it's very much in our DNA, this kind of big quiet. And it was also the early 60s, so there just was this societal kind of, nobody talked about anything that might be hard to talk about. So I had this silence of nature, which I was very drawn to, and silence of my family that I was just born into. And then I was a gay kid in the 60s with no possibility of a conversation. The word gay didn't even exist then. It was just this thing that was not going to ever be discussed. So I always feel like it's circles of silence for me. And then in high school, when I started high school, I had a teacher who just was one of those people that took a good look at me and said, why don't you look at this thing called silent acting? And I tell the story in the show, too. It's absolutely true. He just had me look at the art of pantomime, and it was just like finding the coat that fits. I know exactly what it was.
I'm sorry, I don't want to stop you, but I like to talk a lot whenever it comes up about the impact of teachers.
Yeah.
They can do what was done for you, and they can do the opposite.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, the kind of magic. I interviewed this young woman who was sure she wanted to be an astrophysicist. Mm-hmm. She was certain that this is what she was going to be from a very young age. And even before she knew what astrophysicist was, she was going to be an astrophysicist. Until the teacher who was teaching her show choir said to her, no, you're a theater person. And of course she is.
Yeah.
It's that thing, that magic that some teachers can see and save. You know?
Absolutely.
So, you know, and this is even more extraordinary because that teacher, she was doing theater, she was already, you know, playing around with that, so that teacher had seen something that she could point to, but this teacher, your teacher, it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah. Well, he knew a little bit about mine, he knew what it was, and he just, I don't know, saw something in me. And
right.
And I'm glad you brought that up because I've had I'm very grateful for a number of teachers throughout my life that have just directed me to the next place, you know, and changed my life. It's really changed my life.
Are you thinking of something in specific, particular?
Well, this high school teacher who's no longer alive, and the man who brought me from Montana to the East Coast, a man named Bill Esper, who's an acting teacher.
And how did he bring you from?
I finished college, and was going to be a high school English teacher. And I was happy to, I thought, well, that's just what you do. And, you know, I was a closeted gay man in 1980. And then I was encouraged by another professor named Neil O'Leary. He really, literally kicked me in the butt and said, you should be auditioning. You should audition for graduate schools. You need to basically get out of Montana. And he helped me get auditions for graduate schools. And I was seen by this man named Bill Esper, who said, I want to bring you to this program at Rutgers. I'm just starting. And he picked me up and took me from Montana to there. And I've been there ever since. And now I teach at his studio in New York. So.
Yeah, Deus Ex Machina, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right.
Okay, well,
that never would have happened without these men. And another art teacher named Leela Audio, I want to credit her, who just always said, you can do this. You're an artist. You can do it.
So. That's okay. Back up. Because I want to see the link. You know, the through line. Because now what we have is a five-year-old boy who says, oh my God, nobody is talking and I can't talk. And then we have, how old were you when the teacher told you about mime?
15.
Oh, okay, so there's a big stretch. There's 10 years when you don't know what the fuck is going on, right?
Yeah, and it was a very hard time. That was a really, really hard time in my life because I was a kind of coming of age and realizing that I was probably a gay person and that meant you should kill yourself or you're going to get killed. Basically, that's what I meant in Montana. And I started my first year of high school. I had D's and F's. I was a very depressed kid. And this teacher
saved your life.
Yeah.
Right.
And the other part of that teacher I ended up having a relationship with. He was a married man with kids. And that was another thing that was horrific, but also
confirming.
Confirmed something and also kind of made me realize that I couldn't live my life like that, you know. So it was a very strong message for me. Like, oh, I actually can't do that. I have to be honest. I have to find my own truth with it.
So again, you found someone who, this is such a mixed blessing, right? Mm-hmm. But you found someone who couldn't speak their truth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Which, wow.
Yeah.
So you have this really difficult 10-year period from 5 to 15 when he opens this door for you. Well, several doors for you, apparently, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they are, my gosh, it's so interesting, because it's fraught, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the good and the bad.
It is, yeah.
Right? I mean, you must have felt so grateful to him and also trapped.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think my parents were really grateful to him, because academically, I became very successful in school, and he just turned my life around. But I think on some level, although I never talked about it with my parents, I think they knew the other part that was going on too, and it was...
You think they knew?
I do, and they never spoke about it.
Of course not. Right.
So,
well, but they didn't throw you out.
Right. I think they were so grateful that my life was getting better, and I think they probably thought, well, whatever this is, it's helping him.
Right. Right.
That was not completely true, and I know that much more as a grown-up now, but it was actually a really painful, destructive part of my life. But I learned a lot from it.
Yeah.
And it got me out of Montana. But I love Montana. I mean, I should say that, but it wasn't the place I could live at that time.
No, and you couldn't do what you do.
Yeah.
Right? You couldn't be who you are there, and that's the point.
Yeah.
The point, it seems to me, is that you were both very fortunate and very brave. You had so many strikes against you. You grew up someone who didn't fit in a place where what didn't fit was dangerous.
Right.
And you managed to survive it and thrive. It's pretty amazing, actually, I think. I do. I think it's amazing. What keeps coming up for me is that there's all this horrible stuff, and you manage to harvest the good stuff. Hmm. You manage to harvest this work, which you can do. It's a gift. I'm sure you're right. It's a gift. It's not that you suddenly learned to be. You were naturally gifted to demonstrate physically what you wanted to say,
mm-hmm.
Right? You managed to take "I am a gay person" out of that, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
However, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So out of this morass of all these things that could have gone wrong, that you could have... Am I making any sense to you?
No, I feel so grateful that it kind of went this way, because I could well have just been a sad drunk in Montana.
Exactly. No, I think that is much more likely.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of other people certainly are.
Oh, yeah. I know lots of them.
Right.
And I do want to say, just I'm jumping back to teachers now, that that's one of the things that I've really made part of my life, is that I teach, and I especially like to go to places like Montana, and I want to be the person that kids can say, oh, he's an artist. It doesn't even matter if I'm gay, but that's usually, they could pick that up, or they might need to see that. I just want to be that person to say, there's options, you know, you can, yeah.
Yeah,
so
I love
that's
it.
A big, probably the most important thing I want to do.
Yeah. Okay. So we have you going through high school, really juggling, you know, all of the various things that are happening to you. And not thinking I can be a mime. Thinking, well, I'll be an English teacher.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Because I'm smart and I like stories and I'm good at this and all that, and I have to do something for a living.
Right.
And what is a mime anyway? No?
Right? Yeah.
Okay. So, but you must have been in plays or something, because who would have...
Yeah, I was in a lot of plays. I did a lot of theater, and high school theater, like for many kids, really shaped my life. You know, it gave me my social group. It gave me a sense of, you know, inclusion and control, and I felt successful in it. And so, yeah, I did a lot of plays.
Right. So And I have heard this a lot. A lot of people who could not, absolutely could not find themselves,
yeah,
find themselves in drama club or, you know, in the theater department or whatever,
yeah,
right? Okay.
Yeah.
And for all the same reasons that you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, the sense of comradeship, the community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who was it? I think it was Peggy Roeder who said, so I wandered around and I wandered around and I wasn't good at sports and I wasn't good at this. And then I came to the theater place, right? She said, and I thought, I can do this.
Yeah.
you know, right? And 40 years later, she has a 40-year career as an actor, right? So that is how the teacher who said you should be auditioning for graduate schools,
yeah,
in theater,
yeah,
or not,
to, yeah, be an actor.
To be an,
yeah,
actor. That's how come that person knew that, to say that.
Yeah, I had done a lot of plays. That was in college, too. So I had done college theater. And
but you were already, then you're majoring in English to teach in college?
Yeah. Yeah, but I also majored in theater. I double majored.
Ah, so you were going to teach theater, maybe, or teach English.
Yeah, I assumed I, you know, in Montana, you're an English teacher and you get to do the plays.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Or
yeah,
they,
yeah,
throw you another $20 and you get to do the plays.
Okay.
So that's what I had seen. That's what my high school teachers did, and I thought, well, that's what I'll do too.
Right. Until this guy says no.
Yeah, yeah, and then I, boom. And my mother is in there too, because my mother encouraged me. I mean, it must be the hardest thing in the world for a mom to send their child away. And I was really close to my mom, but she...
You were the baby.
Yeah, but she's, you know, a huge part of why I moved to the East Coast, because she said, this is an opportunity. And I remember her saying something like, there'll be a lot of times in your life later when you can say no, but why don't you say yes to this one? You know?
Are you serious?
Yeah, and she... I look at that, I think that must have been an awfully hard thing for her to do as a mom. But she, you know, she really sent me east. She had done it as a high schooler,
oh,
during World War II, because she decided to go work for the war effort as an 18-year-old, and her parents put her on a bus, and she moved to the east. And so I think on some level she was saying, oh, I'm going to let you do that too, because for her it, you know, redirected her life.
Good for her.
Yeah, I know. I really, I credit my mom. She sent me to Marcel Marceau, that was her, and she sent me to the East Coast. She made those things happen.
Okay, so, I'm sorry, I don't remember. You got accepted in something, some school?
I went to Rutgers.
Oh, you went
for
to Rutgers,
graduate,
right,
school in New Jersey.
Oh, this is when the guy saw you and,
yeah,
picked you up,
yeah,
and took you to Rutgers.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is that program? What happened there?
It's an MFA program that's now one of the top, I think it's in the top five in the country. It's a very successful acting program. It was new when I was starting there. And I did a three-year program in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And then from that, I just started working, just doing regional theater and trying to build a resume.
I'm thinking you're an actor.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there was always in my mind, I thought, well, I guess when I'm done with grad school, I'll go back to Montana, but I've never moved back. It just, just one thing has led to the next right thing, to the next right thing, and then you look up and it's 35 years later and you're an actor. You know, I still kind of,
okay,
sound like Pollyanna. I feel like, oh my gosh, I'm making a living being an actor, you know. Mm-hmm.
So, but you're thinking then, when you're getting out of Rutgers, that you're an actor. You're, mm-hmm, not defining yourself as a mime.
No, but I always supported myself. My side job was always doing mime because hardly anybody does it. So I would get calls to go to a workshop for kids. And it was the 80s, so I used to do this thing called the Mechanical Man, which was like this robot thing that was very popular in the early 80s. And I could make money doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my side job for sure. But I had never had any formal training as a mime. I just made it up. But it became, because it's a unique art form, I just started getting more and more calls and opportunities to do it. So then it became kind of a 50-50. And a lot of the jobs I get as an actor, I get because I have
the mime
physical
skill
background. So I do a lot of physical roles. And that led me to kind of more mime attention. And so then the balance started to shift. By the time I worked on Broadway, the two Broadway shows I did both came my way because I'm a physical actor. So clearly it was informing.
Yeah, there's no category for this.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there's actor and there's mime, but there's not, I don't know what, mactor?
Right.
You know?
Right, right.
You know, so when people ask you, what do you say? Do you say, I mean, they say, what do you do?
Yeah, I generally say actor and mime.
Actor and mime.
Yeah. But, you know, mime has such a, you know, strange connotation in the U.S. It's, You know, it's usually the butt of a joke. And I'm terrible about it because I make fun of mimes all the time, and I am a mime. But there is a kind of a connotation of it, like it's that weird guy on the street with white face who's doing stuff I can't understand, you know?
Ah.
And so I come up against that professionally. When people find out I'm a mime, a lot of them are like, oh no, I don't like mime, I don't want to see that. And my style of mime is well, I don't know, somebody, a reviewer a couple of years ago called me a postmodern mime. I don't know what that means, but part of it is I don't wear whiteface, and the other part of it is I'm very naturalistic. I try to just make it very accessible. So I come up against people's prejudices against mine, for sure.
I'm thinking, 'twas ever thus for you. I mean, do you know what I mean? I mean that you started out thinking, what I am doesn't go down well everywhere. I'm not making this, I'm not doing this very clearly. That the sense that others will judge what I am, what I do. I mean, that was there at the beginning, and to some extent that's the same thing with mime.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. Yeah, it's an extension of that kind of other.
You know? Right, I am other than.
I'm familiar with that role, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, you said it so well. Yes. And I like it because I believe too many people are ashamed of something about themselves and trying not to be who they are and not trying not to be the thing that other people will judge or and trying not to be other. Mm-hmm. Hmm? Trying not to be others, yeah. I guess what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when you demonstrate I am other and it's fine, you really do a service, I think.
I hope so. And I think the world, I'd like to think the world's getting better that way. You know,
I
feel, most of the time I'm pretty optimistic about it. Like I feel, well, certainly in terms of being a gay person, I feel like that is opening up in this country. You know, there's going to be backlashes, but I do feel like that's moving in the direction that it should.
I agree, and I'm thinking that most of the catastrophes that are going on all over the world are people for whom some other is not all right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All that does is cause catastrophe.
Yeah, and sadly, that's the oldest story in the world, too. It's like the us and them. You know?
Yeah, right. Okay, so you go to graduate school, and then you said things kept coming up. So what came up?
I just started working. I got an internship at a regional theater, and I did shows. I did everything. I worked in the box office, and I cleaned toilets, and I did a lot of things, and it allowed me to be in the plays, and I got cast in a few plays, and because it was a union house, eventually, if they wanted to use me anymore, they had to offer me a union card, and they offered me one, so I joined Actors Equity, and then promptly didn't work again for 2 years, because that's what happened, so then I became a sheetrocker, and worked at some places in New York, doing sheetrocking, and being kind of miserable, but I continued auditioning, and teaching mime classes, and that kind of thing.
On your own?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I just worked in regional theater for a number of years. And eventually what I learned, that some people advised me, to say, like, if you want to work on Broadway, you have to stay in New York for a while. So I started to say no to jobs and say, no, I'm going to try to stay here and take the risk, and eventually that paid off, and I got jobs on Broadway. And
you did what your mother said.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, were things to say no to.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
So that kind of was a great experience to be able to do that, but what I learned working on Broadway, which I would certainly do again, but what I learned was what I love about theater is feeling creative, and in big Broadway shows, it's a big Broadway machine, and there's not a lot of latitude. So I learned about duration, and I made great friends, and I fell in love, and all of that was fantastic, but there was a part of me that wanted to be making my own stuff and making my own work.
Yeah, and that's actually where I'd like to go now, because my experience of you is you're doing your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your show, which is extraordinary, really, partly because the story itself is interesting, you're interesting, and you're very funny, you know, which is so delightful. I mean, and so you can, I'm saying all this because you should be coming out to see Bill, who will be at
the... I'm in the Unplugged series at the Oslo here in Sarasota, and I am working on a new solo play, and I'll be doing it on March 15th at the Oslo, and I don't know the time, but you could go to the Oslo website and look for the Unplugged series, which is a new play series.
So what's clear is that you did at some point decide to create your own vehicle.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just Mechanical Man and, you know, Broadway, but but it's Bill's thing,
yeah.
Right? So how did that happen?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked that because I didn't really set out to write a solo play. I didn't see myself as a writer at all. And I had written mime pieces, you know, little performance pieces because I'm a mime and people would ask me to do a story, or, you know, and so I'm a big Charlie Chaplin fan, so I wrote pieces and I had some silent vignettes that I did. But the way that writing a play happened was I have a lot of, you know, weird stories that I've been known for through the years. I had started just kind of becoming a storyteller at cast parties and family reunions, and I would tell my wacky stories of things that happened to me, mostly because I'm a mime, or I just had a lot of funny stories. That was how
you mean people would say, tell us a story, Bill?
All the time. It happens to me all the time.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I just, that was how I made friends, was like, and probably protected myself, honestly. I just was the funny guy who would tell the story. And when I was in The Scarlet Pimpernel on Broadway, I became known as the storyteller guy, and they every night when I put my wig on in the wig room, I would tell a story. And my friend Jill, who was in there in the play with me, said, I think you could write a play with this. And I thought that was hilarious. And he gave me the number of his friend, who was a director, and said, I think you should call her. She could help you with this. And I didn't call her. But then I went to The Lion King the next year, and it got to the point where my dressing room would have people in it during intermission to hear stories. And my now husband, Michael, gave me a book for my birthday that year, and that on, it was a blank book, but on the cover he wrote, I know this much is true. And he said, write a play.
Oh, my.
And so I just started writing just ideas down of my stories, and it led to just trying them out in front of people. And that director whose number I got came into my life by kind of fluke about 2 years later. And I talked to her about the idea, and she said, let's try it. So I just got up and told some stories, and she was able to hear them in a way that I couldn't, and ask questions and that I never even knew I could ask myself. And it started to find its shape as a play. And
how long a process was that?
Oh, my gosh, probably about... It took about 3 years for us to make the play that exists now. I did a couple workshop productions of it, but it was a very long process, much longer than I thought. And it's a completely different play than I set out. I had no idea where that play was going. It has a life of its own.
Well, this play has a through line.
Yeah. I didn't have that through line when I started.
No, this is not simply a bunch of stories. This is a story.
Yeah.
In which a lot of stories lead, but, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I didn't have that idea at all. In fact, the piece I'm working on at the Oslo is right now just a big pile of stories, too, and I'm hoping somewhere along the line it finds its shape as well. But usually I find that shape in front of an audience, so I have to get up and tell these stories for a while. And a lot of times the audience helps me learn what I'm saying.
Well, and my understanding of what you have described as your life is that if not that, someone will come along and tell you what it is.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, so now you have a life in which you teach, because you teach here at the Oslo, you teach wherever you, I guess, you know, you're teaching mime, basically, right?
I have a couple anchor, I call them anchor jobs in New York. I teach at NYU. In the fall semester, and I teach at the Bill Esper Conservatory in the spring semester, and year-round I teach at the Stella Adler Conservatory. And I teach mime and creative movement, which is essentially physical improvisation, small group ensemble, how to make theater out of nothing, that kind of idea.
Yeah. Okay. So you do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you get a Broadway show, you'll do it, right?
Sure.
Right. And then you do this other thing, which is your solo performances, right?
Yeah. I have three solo pieces that I've written over the past 10 or 12 years, and I take them on the road, and what gratefully has happened is I've started working a lot in Europe because mine has a tradition in a lot of European countries that it doesn't have here. So there's work over there for me. So that's the next place I go, actually, is in a couple weeks I go to the Netherlands, and then I go to Vienna a month after that. This summer I go to Poland, and it's fantastic because otherwise I would never get to go to those places if I weren't a mime.
So do you do this show there?
I do. I have done this show a lot in Europe, actually. And I'm doing another show called Beyond Words, which is stories about boyhood to manhood, and which culminates in my having a son, actually. So I'm doing that show a few times in Europe this spring.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So it seems to me that you have done everything that can be done with this this gift that you have. So is there something that you have not yet done that you have wanted to do?
Yeah, actually, the next thing I really want to do is write a book, because my tendency is to write autobiographically, and I think I have a memoir in there somewhere.
Yes.
And I also really love teaching mime, and there's hardly any mime in America, and I would just like to write about that. So I'm trying to figure out the form that might take. It could be a memoir and a mime book, or it might be two separate things, but that's on my mind. What I have to find is a way to take some time to sit and write. And, you know, the good news and the bad news is I make my living as a performer, but that means I have to go somewhere and perform.
Yes.
So I just mostly have to invent a way to take a chunk of time and write some things down. But that's really what I'd like to do. Yeah.
Then my guess is that you will.
Because
you've done everything that has occurred to you. Right? You're not thinking of doing the Bill Bauer School of Mime.
Well, I love teaching mime. I would like to also have a company. I think that would be neat.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that is taking shape in that I teach a lot in New York, so I do have some students who are interested in continuing it. And I'm writing a play right now that's a larger cast play. I'm adapting a novel that's going to be done in New York this next year. So I think that might be the beginning of an ensemble.
Finding time to write this?
Well, I've written a good chunk of it, but the next thing we need is to go into rehearsal because I don't really know how to write. I write by moving or seeing things moving. So we have to just take a chunk of time, which I have. I've finagled a way to get some free rehearsal space in New York in May and June. And so I'm working with the director, and we're going to get a group of people together for a couple weeks and to see what we get.
Is it a lot mime?
No, it's actually a novel you may know called Johnny Got His Gun by Dalton Trumbo.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a book that I read in high school that I've been thinking about it since I was in high school. It's a long time ago. And it's actually the ultimate one-person show because it's the story of one man's thoughts about surviving in World War I, but he survives in heart and mind, but he doesn't have eyes or ears or any arms or legs. Everything is gone but his heart and his mind. And that's what the book is about. But what I want to do is expand that out so the story is told by a group of people.
Wow.
So that's what I'm working on now.
Wow. Well, all right. So I only have one more question. Having given a life, and you really have given a life, to using your body and your mind to communicate, giving a life to performing, entertaining, sharing, demonstrating. What would you say about what that's like?
Well, I don't know how to do anything else. That's what it's like. You know, I'm 55 now, and every once in a while I think, oh my God, I forgot to get new skills. You know, there's like bankable skills that,
Actually, that's not what you mean. You mean conventional skills.
Conventional, yeah.
Because you have plenty of bankable skills.
Yeah, yes. I guess I mean bankable in the sense that what a lot of other people do. So I don't have things like an IRA or a retirement. You know, things that start you start to think about in your 50s.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I think, oh my gosh, I didn't do any of those things.
Right.
And I'm not, most of the time I'm not, I don't regret it. It's just interesting. My life has just been kind of, I always feel like it's just doing the next thing in front of me, the next thing that seems right, and I've made it this far. So I'm grateful for that, and I'm also a little amazed I've made it this far, because it's a strange vocation to be a performer.
Well, it's a strange vocation to be a performer. You're more than a performer. You know, I mean, you're a role model.
Oh, gosh.
Don't you think that's true?
Oh.
Or are you just embarrassed?
I don't know if I want that responsibility, but thank you.
It's not a responsibility. You can't help it. It's not something you do. It's something you are. And I think you are.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. This is a great place to stop. I don't know what else I would do. This is the quintessential statement of a person who is being who he is. He alludes to problems that come with the choices that he made based on who he is, but he says, I couldn't be other than I am. And of course, that's the point of the show, that it is possible to be who you are. And when you are who you are, it is not possible to be other. That is what is right, what we therapists call congruent. And when you find that, when you are that, then there's a certainty about that and a comfort and an ease. You are no longer in conflict with yourself. In the book I wrote, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I have a whole chapter that I call Civil War. And this is talking about the experience that so many people have at being at odds or at war with themselves. I don't want to be this person. I want to be someone else. I wish I wasn't like this. This tug of war, that I am not somebody that I want to be, that I am pleased with, that I am proud of. This is a terrible way to live. And I believe that only happens when your childhood has convinced you that something about you is not okay. And then you grow up feeling that something about you is not okay, that you could not like it. So I say and believe that when you are who you are, when you have rediscovered everything that your childhood may have forced you to deny about yourself, that life is easier. But as Bill points out, and as so many of the artists that I have interviewed pointed out, that doesn't mean that it has no downside. For so many artists, the downside has to do with finances or security, or having an IRA. But they all say exactly the same thing. Yes, yes, I don't have that, and maybe it would be nice to have that, but I wouldn't do this differently. I can't do this differently, because one cannot be other than one is. When one is oneself, there isn't other. I don't want to give the impression that being at one with yourself makes all problems disappear. It doesn't. But it makes one problem disappear, and that's the Civil War problem. The problem of being at war with yourself. That one is so painful, so debilitating, and so unnecessary. So, I don't think I got an opportunity to say that if you want to hear this interview again or any of my interviews, if you want to get a copy of my book, if you want to ask me a question, I'd be happy to hear from you. And, oh, you do this by going up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. So, as always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show. Something that intrigued you, something that tickled you, something that you didn't know which you now know, something that you did know but had forgotten, or something you knew but were reminded of. Well, you know, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going. On singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got to